Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to introduce the second of this year's Robbins Lectures. I think most of you were probably here yesterday, and the fact you've all come back today shows how very much you all appreciated the first lecture. And I only want to say one thing about Carl Otto Pearl, which is to reveal to you the origins of his success. Now, some of you may know that I'm a former journalist, but you may not know that he is also a former journalist. But unlike many distinguished journalists, he actually began his career as a sports writer. And I'm sure this is why he has such a profound understanding of financial markets. He also managed to pay his way through university as a sports writer, which is perhaps not so easy today. But he did, of course, graduate to being an economic journalist in the 1960s before going into the finance ministry and the central bank. Now, I'm tempted to say that here, instead of economic journalists becoming head of the central bank, they simply go on telling the central bank what it ought to be doing and disagree with it. They don't often get a chance to practice what they preach. But things are changing. As you may know, very recently the Bank of England appointed a new deputy governor who was the editor of The Economist. So quite clearly, looking at Germany, they thought there must be something in the idea that good economic journalists make good central bank governors. We have a saying, Carl Otto, that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So I hope you take it that way. And you're now going to talk to us, I believe, mainly about European monetary integration. We all look forward to that. And may I just say, I hope that some of the students here will ask questions. Don't leave it all to the journalists. After all, you might become journalists too if you ask sufficiently penetrating questions and central bank governors.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm impressed that the room is almost fully occupied, even after my lecture last night. Talking about journalists, Christopher, there's a saying by Bismarck, you know, famous German statesman. He said it's possible to promote a good journalist to a state secretary, but the other way around, it's much more difficult. And I can only confirm that statement, because it was a good school. I learned a lot, particularly in writing about sports, not only because I became able to recognize a foul, but also to formulate a sentence in a way that normal people were able to understand it, which also you cannot take that for granted. And I hope you will say that about my lecture, finally. So yesterday I talked about international cooperation in the area of monetary policy in the context of the G7 and G5, the big industrialized countries, and the efforts to stabilize exchange rates. Today, I want to talk about monetary cooperation in Europe, which, of course, did not start with the Maastricht Treaty. But like the G7 cooperation in 1973, because 73, as I explained yesterday, was the year when the post-war system of fixed exchange rates, which was agreed at the end of the war in 1944 in Bretton Woods. And one of the fathers, as I have mentioned yesterday, was Lionel Robbins, and of course Maynard Keynes, when this system finally collapsed. So the world was in a state of floating, by the way, like today again. And, of course, everybody was very anxious and worried about that. And it was particularly, I think it's fair to say, the then, at that time, German finance minister, Helmut Schmidt, who later became Chancellor of Germany, who wanted to organize European group of countries floating against the dollar, but having fixed exchange rates amongst each other. And he tried to achieve that. He met with Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who was the finance minister in France at that time in March 73. And I attended these meetings. There was also the British chancellor, Tony Barber at that time. And at the beginning, there was a slight readiness, particularly on the side of the prime minister in this country, Edward Heath, to participate in such a European floating bloc. But finally, the Bank of England and the Treasury, the experts in the Treasury, were very much against it, and they were so afraid about the role of Britain as a reserve country, sterling as a reserve currency, that Britain did not participate in that so-called snake. So it was from the beginning mainly a French-German event, very similar to the EMS later. A French-German event, of course, with the participation of some smaller countries and with special rules for Italy. So 5 years later, in 78, well, I should say that the snake didn't work very well, actually. France left the snake twice, and it was a very turbulent time with much volatility of exchange rates. And so the British decision not to participate in that arrangement of fixed but adjustable exchange rates was certainly justified, because in 1976, Britain and sterling came under heavy, heavy pressure, and Britain had even had to approach the IMF for a bridging loan. So I think the snake wouldn't have survived that, and Britain wouldn't have been able to maintain a fixed exchange rate under this circumstances. There was the oil crisis and all these things which didn't make it easier. And France, even France, was forced to leave the snake twice. And at the end, after 5 years, in 78, we were really in a more or less in a state of floating. We were in a situation which was very similar as far as exchange rates and monetaries situation is concerned, very similar to the situation we have today, because there was only a core group led by Germany with some small countries pegging their currency to the D-mark, and all the major currencies were floating, including France, the French franc, British pound, Italian lira, etc. So in July 78, at the occasion of a German-French summit meeting, bilateral summit meeting, Helmut Schmidt and Valéry Giscard, who both had been promoted, so to speak, one to the Chancellor of Germany and the other to the President of the French Republic, surprised the world and the Bundesbank, I have to add, with a proposal to establish a European monetary system centered around a currency unit called ECU, in English, European Currency Unit, but in German and in French it has some association with the coin which was issued in the Middle Ages, medieval times, both in France and in Bavaria. There was not only an ECU in France, but in Bavaria. Nobody did really remember that, but it was a nice symbolic thing, maybe in order to persuade the Bavarians to participate in that arrangement. More important than this semantic considerations was the idea, the original idea of the EMS and of this proposal by Schmidt and Giscard, that after 2 years one should enter into a so-called second stage and to pool the currency reserves, or at least a substantial part of the currency reserves, of the participating countries, allowing practically unlimited interventions to defend the exchange rate system. The Bundesbank was alarmed. I was deputy president at that time, fortunately not the president. Maybe I had to resign already that time. The Bundesbank was alarmed, and I have never even in the process of German unification, not in that process, witnessed such dramatic discussions in the Central Bank Council, because the Central Bank Council was anxious that this system could become an inflation machine with unlimited interventions. And I think this anxiety was very, very justified. And the relationship between Chancellor Schmidt and the president of the Bundesbank, Ottmar Emminger, and the council became so critical that Schmidt even threatened to change the Bundesbank law. He has written that in his memoirs, by the way, so it's on record. But it was a completely unrealistic consideration, because he would have never got a majority for that in parliament. So after months of negotiations, both in the Ministerial Council in Brussels and in the Committee of Central Bank Governors in Baal, the Bundesbank, actually Ottmar Emminger and myself, we finally succeeded in changing the Schmidt-Giscard proposal. The system became, as it was later called, asymmetric, which means that the debtor country got, in this arrangement, generous but limited credit facilities, and most important, credit had to be settled, had to be repaid within 6 months in the currency of the creditor. This rule was slightly expanded in the Baal-Niborg agreement in September 1987, which also included credits for non-obligatory interventions. But basically, this rule exists until today. And this was one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why countries had to give up interventions and had to practically leave the EMS last year, UK, Italy, and this year France and others. Because their currency reserves were exhausted, and they reached a point where they could not continue buying their own currency, because they had finally not enough hard currency to settle the debt within the rules of the system. Well, it's of course asymmetric. The creditor has less obligations than the debtor, but the Bundesbank thought that was, and I think the Bundesbank was right in that respect, it was the element of discipline in that system, because with unlimited interventions there wouldn't have been no reason for any government ever to change an exchange rate. Maybe that the fears of the Bundesbank have been exaggerated, that intervention obligations under a system of fixed exchange rates would again, as under the Bretton Woods system, undercut its ability to pursue a monetary policy aiming at price stability. But finally, I think it was the discipline applied in the system and the main reason why realignments took place when necessary. Unfortunately, most of the time under heavy pressure in the markets. I can't remember any realignment actually in the EMS, or very, very few, let's say, very, very few realignments in the EMS which have not been forced on the governments and central banks by market pressure. Actually, on the other hand, frequent realignments which we had at the beginning of the system until 1973 did, of course, also add some uncertainties to the system. And the system was even put at risk because of this one realignment after the other. I think we had 9 realignments from 1980, from 1979 until 1983. And the real change came towards stability of the system in 1983 when France drastically changed its economic policy. You know, in France, the socialists had come to government, and then at the beginning they pursued very expansionary policies in order to get the economy moving, stimulate the economy, so on. But then the French franc came under pressure as a consequence of that and as a consequence of higher inflation, etc. And so France was at that time in March 83 really at a crossroad. The finance minister in France at that time, by the way, was a man named Jacques Delors, who later became very prominent, as you know. But then Jacques Delors, he can take the credit for the change in French policies, I think, because it was not undisputed in France. And finally, the French changed their policy by 180 degrees and put the stability of the exchange rate, gave that the highest priority. And from then on, the system became more stable. There was only one or two more realignments from 1983 until very recently when the system collapsed, or at least for the time being. And that change in French policy made it also easier for Germany and for the Bundesbank to welcome newcomers, which there came more and more countries wanted to become not only members of the EMS, but also wanted to participate in the ERM, in the exchange rate mechanism of the EMS, which Britain, for instance, was always a member of the EMS, but did not participate in the exchange rate mechanism until, as you know, 3 years ago. By the way, it was I gave a lecture here at the London School of Economics in this room, and that was exactly the time when the UK joined the ERM after heavy discussions here in this country whether that was a right or wrong decision. So I think the acceptance of the D-mark as the system's key currency and of the policy of the Bundesbank as its anchor, as it was called, though unintended and reminiscent of other key currencies problems, also helped the EMS to achieve cohesion and credibility in the years later, with central rates essentially fixed since 87 at least. I would say even 83, it started 83 and then became more and more stable. The growing conviction that at least the members of the core group of the EMS would resist changes in their nominal exchange rates against the D-mark, it could be claimed, and at least I have said that at that time again and again, and I'm still of the opinion that this could be claimed as a so-called quasi-monetary union already. The essentials of a monetary union were already defined in the Werner Report 1970. I just want to recall that in brief. The essentials of a monetary union are unlimited and irreversible currency convertibility. That's the first element. The second element is full liberalization of capital transactions and full integration of banking and financial markets. So, by the way, a reintroduction of capital controls or things like that would be exactly the opposite of a monetary union, of the way to a monetary union. And only a few years ago, some countries in Europe abolished their capital controls, France and Italy, Spain, etc. And there are still some capital controls in existence. So, but before the system collapsed last year and this year, I think we were moving into the direction of an integrated financial market, which is one of the main preconditions for a monetary union. And then, of course, finally, the elimination of fluctuation bands of margins, or in other words, the irreversible fixing of exchange rates. These are the main elements of a monetary union. So we were, as I said, very close to that already. And one indication was the narrowing of interest rate differentials. Because in a monetary union, in one market, you have only one price. So in last year, until last year, we were very close to that. Interest rate differentials in Europe became narrower and narrower all the time. Of course, there was one element missing, very important element of a monetary union, and that is a common monetary policy, finally. But the monetary policy in that quasi-monetary union was, of course, pursued more or less by the Bundesbank. This phenomenon that a national central bank finally decides on monetary policy in such a system, I think was one of the reasons why it didn't work at the end. And it was, of course, the main reason why we got the discussion again, which we had already in the 60s once, the discussion again whether this quasi-monetary union called European Monetary System had not to be developed into a full monetary union, including a common monetary policy. So, and that was also the background, I think, the background for the famous remark by Alan Waters, which was so often quoted when he said the EMS is half-baked. I think he was absolutely right. The system was half-baked. It was not a floating system anymore, and it was not a fully monetary union. It was something in between, and one couldn't stay there. One had to go ahead. So considerations which were mainly expressed in France and in other countries, which didn't like, of course, the leadership of the Bundesbank. And I have to admit, it's very hard to, it's very understandable that they didn't want to become more and more subject of decisions which they could not influence. This permanent complaints finally led to a proposal, again a very surprising proposal, by the German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher. Very interesting that he made that not the economic minister or the finance minister or the president of the Bundesbank made such a proposal. It was the foreign minister who made the proposal to establish a European currency and a European central bank, which is only a synonym for a common monetary policy, only the institutional side of a common monetary policy. Of course, the success of the EMS paved the road in that direction, and it was not without logic to say, well, if we want to have this system, fixed exchange rates, why shouldn't we go one step further, fix the exchange rates indefinitely, and then set up an institution which is responsible for the monetary policy in that union. So the logic was convincing, I have to say. It's still convincing. But of course, the procedure was not very agreeable to the Bundesbank, and in particular to myself as the president of the Bundesbank, because at the summit meeting in Hanover, it was decided by the heads of state and government that a commission or a committee should be established under the chairmanship of the president of the EC commission, who has never been in charge of monetary policy. The commission actually has no competence in that field at all. And that under the chairmanship of the president of the EC commission, the central bank governors plus some experts should make proposals for an economic and a monetary union and for the procedures to get there. I have to say, and I do not hesitate to say that today publicly, but I hesitated for a number of days to participate in such a committee because it put me in a conflict of interest. I was responsible for the German currency, and I was asked to make proposals which would finally lead to the transfer of decision-making power from the Bundesbank to a supranational institution. But I was persuaded by my colleagues and others to attend this committee, and what would have been the alternative. Even the British Prime Minister, by the way, had approved this resolution at the summit meeting. I told her later, and I was really amazed. But she said it was 4 o'clock at night, and so we finally had to do something. This is the way decisions like that, far-reaching decisions, are taken. Actually, I must say the law report, which was so often later quoted, is a very heterogeneous document if you read it. Because you will see when you read it, you will see that there are very different positions mirrored in that report. There is the German position, which I was lucky enough to get implemented. Independent central bank committed to price stability, at the basic principles of the German monetary policy philosophy. But there's also the French proposal in that, which is not compatible with that. It's completely different, and it's earmarked as a minority opinion, but it's in the report. But the most interesting part of the report is the annex, because in the annex there are all the proposals by all the members, most of the members of the committee. And when you read that, you recognize that there are very, very different views what a European Central Bank and a European Monetary Union, what that could be and should be, and etc. So the report is nothing homogeneous, and in some parts not even very, very clear, but it was accepted by the governments immediately, and it's the basis for what followed the Maastricht Treaty finally. So I thought the central bank governors, who were responsible mainly for the Delors report, should start to to become a little more precise as far as the monetary union is concerned. And I suggested that we should draft a legal document, a statute for a European Central Bank. I was the chairman of the committee of EC Central Bank Governors at that time. But it was accepted by all my colleagues. On the contrary, they were all happy that without the participation of the Commission and others, just the 12 central bank governors of Europe worked on that statute which has become part of the Maastricht Treaty. And I think it's maybe one could say it's the best part of the Maastricht Treaty. At least it's clear. What you cannot say about the whole Maastricht Treaty. There are many passages in the Maastricht Treaty which are everything but not clear. And I also think that the view is today widely shared that the institutional arrangement for a future single currency meet the test of a modern monetary constitution. The yardstick commonly applied is, and what we used as a model was the Bundesbank law. It's often pointed out that the statute of the future European system of central banks, ESCB as it is called, and the European Central Bank, those are two different institutions, that this statute matches the Bundesbank statute in its commitment to price stability as the overriding objective of monetary policy and to independence from political interference. These are the two main elements in that statute. It should be an independent central bank and it should be committed to price stability. That it matches it in its single-minded attention to the essentials of monetary policy and its equipment with the full panoply of instruments required to pursue its task. That it even exceeds the Bundesbank law in some respects. For instance, it does not allow any central bank financing of government deficits, which is not the case in the statute of the Bundesbank. It is also true that the treaty on the statute does not define price stability in very precise terms. National central bank governors are, and that is also something which was criticized in that statute, should be appointed for only 5 years as a minimum rather than 8 years as the executive board members and the members of the Bundesbank executive board, as I explained yesterday. The rules on exchange rate, to give you another example, the rules on exchange rate policy vis-à-vis third countries also leave room for ambiguity, and recourse to bank reserve requirements will be subject to the community's secondary legislation. But these are not points, and I could mention a number of other points as well, but these are not points on which the Bundesbank law is tougher or more specific. On balance, to make a long story short, but it's worth to read the text of the statute for a European Central Bank. I think it's really a modern constitution for monetary policy. On balance, as far as the monetary union side of the arrangement is concerned, the Maastricht Treaty may not be a central banker's dream, but it's also not a central banker's nightmare. Well, as a footnote, one could, of course, ask why did the governments why were the governments willing to enshrine this firm commitments to price stability and central bank independence, which, by the way, means also that the national central banks had to become independent, because it wouldn't work otherwise. Why were they willing to enshrine that in the treaty and back them up with strong elements of self-discipline in the fiscal area in particular? Because after all, some of these commitments flatly contradict the views defended up until now by the majority even of member countries at the national level, because we don't have many independent central banks, etc. So one explanation could be, of course, that the central bank governors would be allowed to draft this statute, and that nobody dared really to speak against them later. But I don't think that is really a very convincing explanation. I think it goes a little deeper. I think the main reason for that is that it was a golden opportunity, so to speak, that at that time price stability was and had been a very important priority of policy in practically all European member countries. All governments had understood at the time that price stability is a very important basis for growth, employment. That is not a contradiction, as we discussed yesterday here. There was a question on that issue, but a precondition for growth and employment and this kind of economic goals. It's hard to tell how durable this anti-inflationary consensus in Europe will be. There are signs that it may have reached its high point and that now other priorities will be established: employment, competitiveness, etc. So it's certainly too early to state that the agreement on price stability as the main priority has been replaced by other priorities. That's certainly too early, but at least what one could say is that the proposals for EMU at precisely the time when the stability consensus seemed most secure was regarded as a unique opportunity which one should not allow to pass. An opportunity to give Europe a monetary constitution based on principles which at other times governments and parliaments might be less willing to accept. And the proponents of this concept is also thought, I think, that once in place, the monetary constitution, adopted and flanked by other irreversible institutional steps, would in turn provide assurance against the emergence of cracks in the stability consensus, at least up to a point. Well, the fact that all European governments, or governments of the EC at least, put their signature under the Maastricht Treaty has demonstrated that they were ready to accept the required wholesale transfer of monetary sovereignty from the national to the community level. That's what the treaty says. But of course, as we know, these declarations were made subject to confirmation by way of ratification of the new treaty in all countries in accordance with the national constitutional provisions. This, at the time, seemed to be rather a formality. But then we got the negative vote in Denmark in June 92, only a little more than a year. And that was a total surprise, even to those close on hand. the Commission, for instance, was completely surprised and unprepared for this negative vote in Denmark. And then, of course, we got the discussion here in this country, in Britain, where it became very clear that Britain was really not ready to give up sovereignty in monetary policy and transfer that to an... of course, Britain had signed the treaty, and finally the Parliament has even ratified the treaty, but if I understand it correctly, there's no readiness here in this country at all to give up decision-making power in monetary policy, to give it in the hands of a supranational institution based in Frankfurt, on top of it. So, and then we got, of course, the French referendum, which was not on the issue of a European currency. That maybe the French would have accepted, but on the issue of political union. And as we know, the result was very, very close. So you could say the glass is half full, but it was also half empty in France. And Germany, very characteristically, made the treaty subject to vote of its constitutional court. That is a very typical German reaction to a problem like this. And the decision of the court is a very strong yes, but. And if you read the decision, you come to the conclusion that the constitutional court, and not only the court, also the government and the Bundesbank in particular, of course, have raised and are raising the stakes for an economic and monetary union to levels where nobody is really ready or able to jump. So today, I think there's only one country in Europe which would be able to fulfill the conditions, the so-called convergence criteria of the Maastricht Treaty, and that is Luxembourg. So, and to go even a little further, one of the main pillars of the Maastricht Treaty and of the concept of an economic and monetary union, namely the EMS, it still exists, yes, but it's very close to a system which one would call, as an economist, one would call it a floating system, more or less. So we are very far away from where we were 2-3 years ago, when we are moving closely, step by step, towards a quasi, or de facto monetary union. Today we are far away from that. We are further away than during most of the 80s. We are much closer to a situation, as far as the monetary situation and exchange rate situation in Europe is concerned, very close, much where we were in 78, 79. So one could argue, of course I wouldn't say that, but one could argue that the creation of this European monetary institution in Frankfurt seems to be a rather academic event without much practical relevance. But I wouldn't say that. I think the EMI, I don't know how you pronounce it here. EMI, the EMI could be useful to in Germany there's a celebration, you know, that this is in Frankfurt, and so people are even ready to sacrifice the D-mark, provided that it's governed in Frankfurt. The EQ is governed in Frankfurt, but I think that this EMI, I want to be serious, I mean, it could be useful in some respects to continue the work of the Committee of EC Central Bank Governors, which indeed was useful in the past very often, and as I said, I was chairman of that group for some time, and I really think this is a very efficient group. And this EMI can try to develop monetary tools, for instance, for a more coordinated monetary policy in Europe, and for even for a common monetary policy, if and when it comes. It can, for instance, try to prepare an agreement for agreed monetary targets in Europe. Well, I think that could have been done in the Committee of Central Bank Governors as well in the past, but since I put my signature under the Delors report, which has proposed a stage-by-stage and step-by-step approach to reach EMU, I think this may be a valuable contribution. But one has to always to be aware that the EMI has no decision-making powers according to the treaty. And that is something I'm sure the Bundesbank will always insist on. The Bundesbank will insist on being the only institution in Germany responsible for monetary policy in Germany, interest rates, liquidity, etc., and that the Bundesbank will not be ready and has not to be ready under the rules of the treaty to share this responsibility with this new institution. So I think the discussions will continue, because even the statute of the ESCB and the arrangement in the Maastricht Treaty leave room for different approaches still. And when considering the issue in all its complexity, the Council of the EMI, which is actually the Council of EC Central Bank Governors, again, may wish to take note of what Professor Harry Johnson has said already in 1971, but which is still valid, and I want to quote that. And he said, "The individual central banks will have to surrender whatever trappings and substance of autonomy they still possess and become more delegates to a central policy-making conference. This will be hard for the proud tradition of national central banking." He continues. And this is indeed the core element of a European central banking system. And there are different approaches, as I said. I want to elaborate a few minutes on that. It sounds maybe a little technical, but I think it's very, very important. There seem to be those who see the future European Central Bank as a very loose congregation of national central banks, allowing the latter much leeway in implementing the very general monetary policy directives agreed at the level of the ESCB's governing council meeting from time to time, on annual targets for an appropriate monetary aggregate or on key central bank interest rates. To defend this position, reference is sometimes made to subsidiarity as a guiding treaty principle. This, I think, points to a serious misconception of the role and the modus operandi of monetary policy. It is interesting to note that insistence on subsidiarity as a governing principle, even in monetary policy, seems most vocal in countries with highly centralized central banking structures. There may be hidden motives behind that, which I do not want to speculate about. But I think you need, if you will ever get a European Central Bank, it has to be a central bank with real decision-making powers, because otherwise it would not be able to pursue a convincing policy. And that is what really finally matters. The idea expressed by some that one could have a rather loose central bank system is a misunderstanding of the, for instance, the German system, because the decision making has to be centralized, and the central bank has to be completely independent. I tried to say that yesterday already, because for a very practical reason, not for ideological reasons, which one could also, of course, mention, and I talked about that yesterday, history in Germany and why we got this independent central bank in Germany. But there's a very practical reason, which I also mentioned yesterday already in the discussion, and that is that you cannot imagine a process in which governments are involved, which would finally lead to convincing decisions in the area of monetary policy. That is inconceivable if one knows the process of decision making as it is in the EC and in other areas. So you really need a group of independent people who decide, but they have a very limited responsibility, in my view at least, and that is they decide on interest rates and on liquidity, on the price and the volume of money, which finally the same two sides of the equation. So the Bundesbank and myself, we always took the position that, for instance, the European Central Bank should not be responsible for banking supervision. But that, of course, that one could leave to the national level in the hands of the national central banks, which have to play a role. But they would not have to play a role, neither the governments nor the central banks, in economic policy, in monetary policy decision making. I can't go in all the details of this European Central Bank statute and system and how it will look and how it will work for time reasons, unfortunately, because I think it's very interesting, not even if you assume that it will take maybe much longer to establish a European Central Bank, or maybe even if you assume that it will never be established, it's interesting to discuss the issues and the problems, because they're also relevant on the national levels. I want to mention only one other aspect, and that is the credibility of the institution. I think one cannot take it for granted that with the best technical provisions that a future European Central Bank would gain the same credibility for the currency for which it is responsible, name it ECU, whatever the name may be, as the Bundesbank. Because it took a long period of convincing policies to gain the credibility which the D-mark has got, as we saw yesterday. If you compare the results, the valuation of the D-mark in the exchange markets, etc. So that again is a big problem, and it would needs, I think, as a precondition for success, and if and when the EMU ever gets off the ground, that the participating countries' economies are in reasonably good shape and with a few risk factors stacked up against success as possible. The global environment is not likely to help much unless economic growth picks up soon without inflation doing so as well. And progress towards closer convergence and cohesion is, of course, not be supported at the time of recession. So the preconditions for a European Monetary Union, and I want to limit myself to that issue mainly, may have seemed favorable during the 80s, but they may not be as favorable today when we have this tremendous problems in so many other areas. And of course, German unification was one of the main factors which have contributed to that, the consequences of this, the introduction of the D-mark, etc., high interest rates in Germany, a wrong policy mix in Germany. So the conditions for EMU, I think, are not as favorable as they used to be, or maybe in the 80s. On the contrary, I think they are much less favorable. So the Maastricht Treaty has been ratified by all member states, but many questions still have to be answered. And the question whether the Maastricht Treaty will ever be implemented is, in my view, at least, to say the least, an open question. It's not the only treaty, actually, which was ratified and which has never been implemented, by the way, in the history of European integration. In my view, and I want to conclude and to finish, because the time is running, in my view, the treaty, one could say, deals to a certain extent more with the past of Europe than with the future of Europe. It deals with the Europe of 12 member states, which was easy to define. Today it's not so easy to define what Europe is. What you can say clearly, obviously, is that Europe does not end anymore at the River Elbe and not at the Oder, that Europe has become much bigger, and that we have to deal with the problems which have arisen from the collapse of communism. The Maastricht Treaty doesn't say anything about that. And I'm not sure that a political union or an economic or a monetary union of Western Europe is the right and the appropriate answer to those countries who rightly pretend to be also members of the European community historically and in their culture and civilization, etc. So I think it has become very obvious in the discussion after the Maastricht Treaty and the referendums in some countries, etc., that the concept of a centralized Europe, we would call it a föderalistisches Europa, a federalistic Europe, but I know that in this country the word federalistic has a different meaning, I think. So federalistic in the sense that it becoming a federation like, like the United States of America, the United States of Europe, which was the original concept for a long time in the 50s and the 60s to create a United States of Europe, and which was still the concept and is still the concept in the mind of some people in some countries, including Germany, also in France, and Italy, and so. But this concept, I think, has become very clear that this is not realistic and it's not the future of Europe. That it's not desirable and it's not wanted by the people, obviously, that more and more power, decision-making power, should be moved, could be put into the hands of a European bureaucracy behaving like a European government and controlled by a 1,000-member parliament. I don't think that is really has a great future, such a concept. In my view, but I've called my lecture a personal view, so it's I'm speaking only for myself, but there is more and more evidence in the public discussion, I think, for that. In my view, what people in Europe really want is a continuation of the process of integration of markets, which has benefited all of us tremendously. And one should really acknowledge that we have made enormous headway in that respect. The single market is really close to be a reality in Europe. But of course, the single market not only for goods and services, but also, as important, for money and capital, because that is necessary for the allocation of investments, etc. A single market may be also for people. That is difficult enough and will become more and more difficult with the rising unemployment in all countries in Europe. We should also recognize, I think, that the end that after the end of communism, as I said already, did not end, does not end anymore at the elder. In other words, that we have to open our markets and that we have to include into a European community or a European Union, however we call it and in what way ever, countries like Poland and Hungary and maybe the Baltic states, and the Scandinavian countries, etc. So the European community, and that is becoming also very obvious every day more, will change its character completely. It will become much bigger, much wider, and so the decision-making processes will, the procedures have to be changed, and we have to leave, I think, as much as possible in the hands of regions and nations. I'm not advocating a renaissance of nationalism, of course not. I'm the last one who would do that. And I don't think it's a correct description what is happening, actually, in Europe. It's, most part, it's not nationalism, what we see. It's more, let's say, self-determination of regions in most countries. And for good reasons. And very much, in many cases, justified. So maybe this Europe will be very loose and very open. But what's wrong with that? On the contrary, I think that is really what we want, and what we don't want is certainly a centralized bureaucracy which takes care of everything. And people don't want that. That has become very clear, and it will not happen. I'm more and more convinced of that. As far as the monetary arrangements are concerned, fixed exchange rates, and as a consequence, finally, a single currency, and a common monetary policy, again, in my view, I think no longer the main preoccupation of governments, at least of some governments, as we have seen last year and this year. We have seen that under the pressure of the markets, of course, not voluntarily, but it happened. And now some governments, I have the feeling, are beginning to enjoy their new freedom after they were freed of this exchange rate constraints, and they are now concentrating on what they think are the real issues. And the real issue in all countries today is, of course, unemployment. I only want to mention as an example, Germany, We have the highest unemployment in Germany since the Great Depression in the 30s. It depends how you calculate. The official calculations say we have 3.5 million unemployed, but if you include the hidden unemployment, you can easily reach figures like 5 million, or some people are even mentioning figures of 6 million. It depends what you include in this figure. It's not a clear figure, unemployment. It is very obvious that this is our main issue and our real issue. And this is not only in Germany. You have the same in Spain with 20% unemployed. You have the same problem in France, wherever you look. And of course, the real issue is, what are we doing with Eastern Europe, Central Europe? What are the consequences if we open our markets? What I think is at least necessary and desirable, but we can't take it for granted, because there will be, of course, tough competition. For the first time, we have the low-wage countries not in Malaysia or in Taiwan, we have them in our backyard, 75 kilometers from Berlin to the Polish border, less than 1 hour drive. And there are more and more companies, in Germany at least, who are moving production to these countries which have well-skilled, trained labor force and wages which are 10-15% of wages in Germany. So these are really the problems we have to deal with and which we cannot solve by establishing a monetary institution in Frankfurt. I mean, this is not the answer to that kind of problems. The real issue, and that is a very serious one, and which is coming, the deadline is coming closer and closer, will be how we maintain free trade worldwide. GATT negotiations, the Uruguay round, and the deadline is the 15th of December. And what will happen if the European community is not able to agree on a free trade approach? That can be the next big threat for the convergence and the cohesion of the European community. Nothing is said about that in the Maastricht Treaty. On the contrary, there are some very protectionist and dirigist elements in that treaty. And the more unemployment is rising, I think, the stronger the tendency to protectionism. International cooperation, to conclude and to finish my lecture, ladies and gentlemen, international cooperation in the 70s and the 80s did not produce a new international monetary order like the Bretton Woods system and even the EMS system, which was quite successful in that respect for more than 10 years, and it's, as I said, it was even close to a monetary union already before it collapsed. If fixed or at least stable exchange rates would be an aim in itself, the last 20 years, I think, could be called a history of failure. But what I think it was more impossible, and what was maybe helped by a certain flexibility in exchange rates, was the fact that it was possible to maintain the freedom of markets, and as far as Europe is concerned, to abolish more and more barriers for trade and for movement of and capital, etc. So this, I think, is quite an achievement. And it's for Europe in particular, the single market, as I said, is not a distant goal. And it's certainly more than just a free trade area. It is the economic basis for Europe to succeed in international competition. If markets will continue to integrate, this could finally lead maybe to a single currency as a consequence. And it then, of course, that would need a single currency, a single market, a single currency, would need also a single or a common monetary policy. But a single currency has to be, in the first place, a stable currency, because sound money is the most important basis for economic growth and prosperity. And to conclude, I want to repeat what I said yesterday in an answer to a question from the audience. As it was said in the communique of the London summit in 1977, and I have to admit I was one of the authors of that sentence, but it could become relevant one day again. Inflation is not a remedy to unemployment, but one of its main causes. So this will remain on the agenda, all the issues I have discussed. And so maybe looking backward and talking about history is not always, hopefully, not always useless. Thank you very much. Could you speak a little louder, please? I can't understand what you say. I'm sorry.
Maybe you better come up and use the microphone.
Come up and use the microphone.
I'd like to answer your question, but I have to understand it.
I think it's in a sense it's unique. Europe is unique in its history and its culture, etc. And the degree of integration in Europe is certainly much higher than in any other region, be it in Asia or in the Americas. But even NAFTA cannot be compared with the process of European integration developed as it is already. I don't think it could be used as a model. It should not be used as a model, neither in the United States, in America. Canada has its own problems. I think I have to answer your question simply with no. This is a unique experiment here in Europe.
We have another question from the gallery, and could you shout?
My question is, do you think it's possible for the European Monetary Union, sort of in the sense of the monetary stability, without a political monetary
system? Yeah, that is I have had that in my long paper here, but I couldn't touch all the issues. Finally, yes, I think we need, and that is the concept of the Maastricht Treaty, of course, and it was mainly emphasized by the German government. The German Chancellor made a big point out of that monetary union, economic union, was not possible without political union. Technically speaking, I think I could imagine a monetary union, without a political union. You can imagine, for instance, a monetary union within a small group of countries. I have advocated that 3 years ago here in this room. I was asked by Rüdiger Dornbusch at the time on that issue, and I have made that proposal again and again, that the core group of countries in Europe should start immediately with the monetary union, but of course only those countries who were both willing and able. There are countries in Europe, which are obviously not willing to participate in a monetary union in the foreseeable future. You name it. And there are others who are obviously not able to participate in a monetary union, because you need a high degree of convergence of economic fundamentals for a success of a monetary union. But there are countries, maybe, I thought at least, that there were some countries in Europe who were both able and willing, and particularly France and Germany and the Benelux. And maybe, in my view, also Denmark could have been at least able to participate. Maybe they wouldn't have been willing. So if this country is the core group of the EC, by the way, also the core group which founded the EMS, they would have just fixed their exchange rates. That would have been rather easy. Then you would have had very soon a single currency with different names. You know, the names could have been the same. As you have, for instance, I was corrected last night by Christopher on that, but let's say the British and the Scottish pound have two names, but it's obviously a currency union, one currency. Or the Luxembourg franc and the Belgian franc, it's one currency, but they have different names, and they have different, they have not a political union in Luxembourg and Belgium. But that proposal was bluntly refused by all governments, including the German government, and it was also said it would lead to a two-speed Europe. Well, I think Europe never developed in one speed, and what do you have today? I mean, we have how many speeds do we have today? This is not a very convincing argument, in my view, not at all. So, no, it was maybe not in compatible with the Maastricht Treaty. So it didn't happen, and I think we missed the opportunity, and I think it's too late for many reasons. I don't think that we will get such a small monetary union in the foreseeable future. Well, I tell you frankly, Britain has not participated in the exchange rate mechanism of the EMS most of the time, and Britain joined the ERM exactly at the wrong moment with the wrong rate, in my view. And because it was just after the German unification and when all these troubles became already visible, and the rate was, in my view, much too high. So it was decided, not by the members of the system, but by the British government, unilaterally. And, well, I thought at that time that it needs two for Tango, at least, because we were on the other side and had to defend this exchange rates. But it was already decided and published, and so we had to live with that. But to me, it was foreseeable that that was not sustainable. It has done a great service, I think, to Britain insofar that it has contributed to the reduction of inflation substantially. I don't think it has really aggravated the employment problems, because unemployment was already high before, and the recession, well, maybe it has contributed to the recession, could be, in Britain. Yes, but now you are not a member of the ERM anymore in this country, and so the British government is free to pursue all the policies necessary to increase employment and create growth and wealth. So we will see whether your professor was right or wrong.
Munich, greater than the interconnectedness between countries or within.
Mm.
Given that it's vital or imperative to have a single currency as soon as possible in order to both reduce economic uncertainty, thereby foster growth and also reduce unemployment.
Mm. Yes, I think basically you are right. If you assume that we are moving further in the direction of a single market, volatility of exchange rates is certainly an element of uncertainty. But of course, it has also some advantages because it gives the member countries more freedom to adjust. And there's always something which has to give in this process of adjustment. If you fix the exchange rates, if you have single currency, of course other economic parameters have to be adjusted. Wages, for instance. We see that in an extreme example in Germany now, with one currency, in two completely different economic regions, so to speak. So something has to give, and in Germany it's employment. The adjustment takes place in the area of employment, because East Germany, there's with the D-mark, with the introduction of the D-mark, the East German businesses, companies lost all their competitiveness. I mean, they were not very competitive before either, I have to say that, for technical reasons and other reasons. But then they lost it completely. And so what we are seeing is a process of deindustrialization. Maybe we have reached the bottom now and it's now getting a little better. But 80% of the industrial capacity in East Germany disappeared. So that is an extreme example, and if you would apply this experience to Europe, if you would introduce tomorrow a single currency, or if you would abolish exchange rates, which is the same, that would of course put an enormous adjustment burden on particularly the poorer countries in the European communities. The poor countries had to adjust. But on the other hand, if you have in an integrated market like the United States, which is always mentioned as an example in that respect, the fact that the United States have had one currency from the beginning, more or less, was certainly an advantage in many respects. And somebody like myself who has to travel in Europe a lot, I tell you, it's very inconvenient to change the money all the time, and always British pounds, and I have to go to Holland tonight, and I forgot to change Dutch guilders, so I hope the taxi driver will accept British pounds when I arrive.
D-marks.
Yeah, I don't have D-marks either. I have only British pounds. You see how much confidence I put in. It's not the subject of my lecture, and I excluded that by purpose. It's a very different question. It's hard to say. It's really history. It came like an avalanche, you know. And so it was not, you know, the unification of Germany is practically the outcome or the result, one of the consequences and results of the, what is much more important, the breakdown of communism. That was the real issue, the breakdown. Without the breakdown of communism in the Soviet Union, we would have never seen that happen. And so it was, of course, the complete failure of that system in Eastern Germany, which finally led to this, the entry of the former GDR into the Federal Republic of Germany. It was not that much a unification, it was rather a joint venture, so to speak, you know. But and very much urged by the East Germans. They thought, and to a certain extent they were right, they thought they would get the D-mark, and they wanted to become part of this flourishing capitalistic system, which they always saw on television every evening, and which was of course very attractive and understandable. They wanted to travel and they wanted to have the same cars and television and all these things, which were not achievable for them in that old system. But that was not the only reason, but it was a strong motivation, I think that's fair to say. So, but the main condition was the collapse of communism. What the alternative, whether there would have been alternatives, I don't know. I don't want to speculate about that. Historically speaking, of course, you could have imagined easily, for instance, two German states which have existed. We have had many states in Germany in our history. That is something very different from France or Britain, you know. Germany has never been a state except since 1870. And it was only part of the Kleindeutschland, as it was called. But that's history, and maybe I leave that to our friend.
Now we just have time for two more quick questions. I've identified two people, one there at the front row, one at the back, for the other front row, one first.
Yeah, and I remember that some major people proposed that. And it was when I referred to my lecture here 3 years ago many times already, but that was one of the issues which I had to discuss, and I was rather critical about that proposal for a hard ECU at the time. And some people here in this country didn't like that I made this criticism here. But the point is, intellectually, you could imagine such a concept, and this the concept of a hard ECU proposed by Michael Butler and others some years ago was intellectually very convincing, a very sophisticated concept. But it misses the point. The point is not to get a new currency harder than the D-mark or something like that. The point is who takes the decisions in this area. And today, or until recently, until the collapse of the EMS, the Bundesbank was the institution more or less which took the decisions, and the others had to follow one way or the other, had to adjust to this in order to defend the exchange rate with the D-mark within the system. Today that's no longer necessary. If a country wants to lower interest rates, for instance, and it has not to defend the exchange rate, it can do it. But of course, there may be consequences for the exchange rate. So this is not valid anymore today. But in a system with fixed exchange rates, somebody has to take the decision. And if you have a system where exchange rates cannot be changed at all anymore, and when you have a system where the operators, the governments, are not able to change exchange rates in a reasonable time and without pressure of markets, etc. In such a system, you need one monetary policy. You cannot have different monetary policies. And of course, you can say you have a strong central bank in Europe, which has a very high reputation and has pursued rather most of the time at least, rather convincing policies, etc. Leave it to them. And there are countries in Europe who are saying that. Smaller countries who say, well, we're quite happy with that, with the Bundesbank. Let them take the decisions as long as they try to keep inflation in check and maintain, are committed to price stability, it's fine. We follow them immediately. The Bundesbank raises interest rates, we follow the next hour, and the other way around. But this, and that has become very clear during the last number of years, this is not acceptable for bigger countries like, let's say, Britain, for instance, or France. It's the dilemma, France. It's not acceptable, and therefore the French and others in Europe have always argued, and I not only understand that, I think it's absolutely logical to argue that in such a system with fixed exchange rates, you cannot leave monetary policy only to one national central bank. You have to have a saying in that process. And that was the beginning of the whole discussion, and I tried to explain that. And of course, then it's a logical answer to that to establish a central bank where all those who are members of this fixed exchange rate system, or finally a monetary union, have a saying in the decision making. And this cannot be substituted by any mechanism. You know, the gold currency, of course, would be a mechanism. Then you leave that there is no decision making necessary because you have an automatic mechanism. But that is unrealistic, and it's never considered. And that the same is with a kind of a hard currency or something like that. It does not really give you the freedom you want, and the cooperation and the participation in the decision making process which is necessary. So last question, and we have to finish. Yeah, well, that is really, I mean, in German, wie der kleine Moritz sich das vorstellt. Some people understand that, yeah. No, first of all, I showed you the charts yesterday, and if you remember, they show that the exchange rates have been more stable since 1987 than before. In other words, we had much more volatility in exchange rates at times when these derivatives were not as developed as they are today and not used to the extent they are used today. You could even argue the other way around. You can say that today the issue of stable exchange rates is not as relevant anymore because the companies and businesses, banks, and etc., are much easier able to protect themselves with this, using this modern instruments. There are also risks involved, but we have had terrible volatility in exchange rates, and one crisis after the other, at times when nobody thought about futures and options and all these kind of things. So I'm not of the opinion that these new financial instruments have increased the volatility of the exchange markets. I'm not even sure whether they have increased the risks in these markets, but that is still an open question. It remains to be seen. The proof in the pudding, or how you say in English. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. So when we get the next crash in the markets, maybe it will be more severe than even the last one. So I don't want to make any forecasts in that respect. Nevertheless, I think that the integration of financial markets worldwide is an enormous achievement It's an enormous achievement, of course not without risks. Nothing is without risks. Whole life is not without risks. But it is an enormous achievement because it helps to allocate capital and investments and so. So I don't think that that is really so negative. And as I said, as far as the stability of exchange rates is concerned, these new instruments have even maybe contributed to more stability in exchange rates. The only thing which is also correct, and that was proven last year here in this country in particular, but this year in France, of course, the markets, this bloody speculators, you know, this Anglo-Saxon, so they can mobilize amounts of money and capital which cannot be matched by governments and even central banks. So that is a strong argument, I think, to leave exchange rates more to the markets than to the governments. So that is, I think, a very good conclusion of my lecture. Thank you very much.
Carl Otto, I would like to thank you very warmly on behalf of both the LSE and the Robbins family, not only for two marvelous lectures, but for your wonderful answers to questions. And I would like to say to all the professors here that any student who reproduces Carl Otto Pearl's answers in his exams should get a very high mark, even if you may disagree with him. And I would just like to also say what a pity it is that it looks as though we're not going to get a European Central Bank while Carl Otto Pearl is still around to be the president of it. But maybe when people look at him, they'll say, yes, he is just the man for the job. We better go ahead and create that bank, and then he can run it for us, and we can have a marvelous European future. Anyway, he's now going to prove some of the puddings in the LSE. I don't know what he'll say about those, but I have to take him to dinner. So anyway, thank you very much all for coming. Let's give him a hand again.